For the week of April 4th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 48, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And high on Mount Olympus, looking down on you mere mortals, I'm Michael Giltz.
And you know what opens today is the 3D movie Clash of the Titans. There's a lot of 3D movies out now. People aren't going to know which one to see. Well, let me help you decide. I'm sure Clash of the Titans is a good movie, but would you learn anything from it? Will it teach you stuff? For example, would it teach you how to train a dragon? No. Movie that taught you how to train a dragon. Wouldn't that be awesome? What you say? There is a movie called How to Train Your Dragon, and that's the one I'll see this week. I'm in it. That's why. I'm in it. Now, I admit I am somewhat biased. But to be fair, Clash of the Titans wasn't one of those movies. It wasn't filmed in 3D. The dragon movie was. I was there. But the... But the Titans movie, that was transferred to 3D after the success of Avatar. It was filmed originally in Double D, I think.
Okay, enough of that. Of course, that was Craig Ferguson of The Late Show, and he was talking about the difference in how 3D movies are made, the difference being that How to Train Your Dragon was made for 3D and in 3D, and Clash of the Titans was shot in 2D and then converted to 3D. That is something we're going to be talking about a little bit later on during our episode, during our Inside Baseball segment. However, before that, we're going to be talking about a number of things, including what Will Smith might be up to, a Hangover sequel, and we're not talking about what Karen might be suffering right now. a little bit more about Justin Bieber, because we just don't talk about him enough.
And Baby.
Okay. Oh, no. We've created a monster, a second monster.
And we'll even talk a little bit about Ricky Martin. Gee, I wonder what we're going to say about him. But of course, first, and as always, we start with box office news with Michael Giltz.
And it was a big weekend at the box office, even though I wasn't feeling well and stayed home and didn't see anything at the theaters. But everybody else went to see Clash of the Titans, which grossed $61 million in the U.S. and another $44 million overseas for $105 million worldwide. Did it make $61 million because it was in 3D or despite being in 3D? We'll never know. But at number two was Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married 2, which grossed $30 million. And if I could invest in Tyler Perry, I would, because he's incredibly dependable. Every single one of his movies makes money. And number three was the originally shot in 3D, How to Train Your Dragon, which grossed another $29 million. It only fell by 33%. It had a very good hold. It's at $92 million total in the U.S. now. I'm not sure how it's tracking overseas. Yes, I do. It grossed another $38 million overseas and has earned $100 million so far around the world. So that's about $200 million so far. Again, you know, you should never write off a movie just because of its opening weekend. It got great reviews. It's having a good hold. So it's doing well. Miley Cyrus is at number four. She grossed $16 million over the weekend, $25 million since her movie opened on Wednesday. For a movie that cost $20 million to make, that's a success.
And the name of the movie is The Last Song, we should say.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Thank you. And at number five is Alice in Wonderland, which grossed another $8 million, $309 million in the U.S. It's approaching $700 million worldwide, which will make it one of the 40 biggest hits of all time. It's, you know, we get used to these numbers, but it's amazing how much money these movies are making. And, of course, the box office as a whole did set a record for Easter weekend. Clash of Titans was by far the biggest opener on Easter weekend. It shattered the record held by Scary Movie 4, which grossed $40 million. Clash of the Titans, of course, at $61 million. That's like 50% bigger. So it's a massively successful weekend. And number 6 through 10 were the usual holdovers, Hot Tub Time Machine, which grossed another $8 million. So it's at $27 million total. The Bounty Hunter, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which is a big success. It cost $50 million to make. It's grossed $46 million total. She's Out of My League, and Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island. Avatar, by the way, out of the top 10 and grossing less than $1 million a week. We're almost done talking about it, Karen, until it debuts on DVD.
Or until it comes out in theaters again in an extended version.
And then comes out on DVD again in the fall.
Right. Well, now, the thing with Avatar is it lost a lot of screens this week. as did Alice in Wonderland. And that's because How to Train Your Dragon was taking up some 3D screens, and Clash of the Titans was released in 3D. However, the thing to keep in mind is that How to Train Your Dragon did not lose a single 3D playdate. However, it may have been moved to smaller auditoriums.
Right. Well, Alice in Wonderland is on 3,000 screens, but they're just mostly 2D screens. How to Train Your Dragon is on 4,000 screens. Clash of Titans on 3,700 screens. But like 1,600 of the Clash of Titans screens are in 3D, which means about 2,000, most of its screens are 2D. That's the way it is in my neighborhood. You see one location has, you know, a 3D listings and twice as many showings in 2D, which is how I would see the movie when I go see it personally. But that seems to be true around the country.
Well, yeah, 1,810 screens in 3D accounted for about 52% of Clash of the Titans.
And that's very low, right? That's very low for a 3D movie. Usually, like, it's more like 70 or 80% of their income, especially on opening weekend, comes from 3D screens, right?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell because it's always increasing based on the fact that we now have, instead of 3,500 screens that are 3D capable, we now have 4,100 screens in North America that are 3D capable. So it's not something that you can compare year over year or even month over month because it is changing that quickly.
Well, I can. It's a lower percentage than most of the recent movies that have come out in 3D. It's far lower. So I think a lot of people did get the message that Clash of Titans wasn't shot in 3D, wasn't meant to be seen in 3D, and there was no good reason to pay extra money to see it in 3D. And some of the reviews pointed out that the 3D wasn't very good. So I think an increasing number of people said, you know what? I'm going to go see this movie in 2D.
Right. Well, I know I saw it in both, but that's just because, you know, I have to. I work in that space. But
Was it like compared to 2D and 3D? I saw How to Train Your Dragon in 2D and 3D. And I felt the difference, and I felt it was better in 3D because that's how it was shot. And I did enjoy it more seeing it in 3D. What do you think of Clash of the Titans?
I think the 3D there looks pretty bad, frankly. You know, not to point a finger at anybody. I just think that it was shot in 2D, it was thought out in 2D, and you have to shoot a certain way and edit a certain way when you know you're converting to 3D. When Tim Burton made Alice in Wonderland, he most certainly did that, and you could tell that he knew from the very beginning that this was a film, though shot in 2D, it was going to be dimensionalized or,
right,
or, you know, put into 3D in post-production. So he shot it that way and edited it that way. Whereas Clash of the Titans, you know, it was only 9-10 weeks ago that they decided to put this thing into 3D, and it just didn't work, really. It looked like it was on three planes, foreground, middle ground, and background, and it looked kind of like cardboard cutouts.
And how was the movie?
It looked like cardboard cutouts. No, I was like, gee, I didn't
was
really...
It got terrible reviews. You didn't like it, I take it.
No. I mean, not really. Not all that much, no.
Karen, how did you enjoy Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married 2?
I didn't see that movie. I'm sure you know. I saw The Runaways.
How was it?
Release in L.A.
Now, this was a movie that is effectively a biopic about Joan Jett and her first band, starring...
Not effectively, it is a biopic.
Right. It's based on the book by Cherie Curry, who was the lead singer of The Runaways. And it stars Dakota Fanning and Kristen Stewart. And it's not a fantastic movie, but I loved it. It's a really good movie. No, it's a good movie. But I know that it's getting kind of like, it's getting good reviews, but not great. And there's a reason for that. But it's an incredibly enjoyable movie. Dakota Fanning is so good in this. And Kristen Stewart really just, she is Joan Jett. She does a fantastic job. It's a really enjoyable movie. What was really weird is that we had that earthquake, that 7.2 earthquake, right in the middle of the movie. And it's so weird to be in a movie theater experiencing an earthquake when you have no context to see anything shaking.
You were in the theater when the earthquake struck?
Yeah.
Did you leave the theater?
No. Actually, that didn't even cross my mind. At first, you're not sure what you're experiencing.
Right.
I thought I was getting dizzy. And then I realized, oh, it's an earthquake. And that's how long the earthquake went, too. And I turned to the girl that I was with, and she was like, are we having an earthquake? And then everybody else kind of turned to each other, and we probably missed, 3 minutes of the movie. But it was weird. Good movie. I recommend it.
Are you guys, your homes are fine? There's no structural damage? Everything's fine, right?
Nothing. I had some pictures fall over, but...
I didn't even feel it.
Yeah, my sister didn't either.
I mean, I was driving, I guess, so apparently you don't feel earthquakes when you're driving, unless, I guess, a bridge falls on your car, in which case you'd feel that.
Yeah, that would definitely be a sign of something.
Yeah, I guess in some movie theaters, one in Century City here in Los Angeles, they had to empty the theater, and some of the... There was a joke, I think, on The Wrap about the movie being in 4D, you know, visually sound, and now, you know, the seats are moving.
Really? At the ArcLight, clearly nobody cares about me because nothing. No one even made a move to stand up. Nothing.
Well, I know we've got a lot of news to cover today, and I think I'm just going to... We should probably just dump it all into Big Deal or Big Whoop and supersize Big Deal or Big Whoop and maybe just talk a little bit about The Hangover. And again, we're not talking about Karen's state of being right now after her Easter weekend and all those jelly beans. But we're talking about Warner Brothers' big comedy, The Hangover. It opened last year to become the most successful comedy of all time, at least financially. And now they're doing, of course, a sequel.
I believe it's the most successful R-rated comedy of all time, right? Yeah. It's not bigger necessarily than any comedy, is it?
It's the biggest R-rated comedy, yeah.
Well, thank you for setting me straight on that.
Now, what fascinates me about this story, and you guys would know better than me, I'm stunned that I assume every single film automatically includes some sort of sequel thing, some sequel clause. And apparently they had no sequel clause in this contract, so that everybody was free and that they had no agreement for, okay, I'll get X amount of money if we make a sequel. There was no deal for anyone for anything. I mean, even if everybody dies in the movie, I assume they have a sequel clause just in case it makes a ton of money and they want to make a prequel. So I'm a little surprised that they didn't plan for it. Just seems...
No,
I just,
they don't plan for these kinds of things. I wouldn't be surprised if that's changing now, but with something like The Hangover, I mean, they really expected this to be a one-off. I mean, nobody even expected it to do well.
Of course, but nonetheless, I thought it was just de rigueur that you include something about sequels.
No.
Right. And now what you're referring to, Michael, is the fact that its stars, the film's stars, Zach Galifianakis, Bradley Cooper, and Ed Helms, did not have option clauses in their contract, so the studio had to go back and negotiate from scratch with all three stars to appear in a sequel. Of course, the movie made just a little bit of money, and they actually combined only earned $1 million for their efforts in the first film. They each got paid about $300,000, and just before Warner Brothers went back to negotiate with them, Warner Brothers, the studio, coughed up $1 million.
Here you go. Actor. Here you go. Here you go. Have $1 million. Now, how about making a sequel?
Right. Well, no, what did they expect to get from that? Like, here's $1 million. Let's hope that you don't ask for quite as much when you negotiate for the sequel. I mean, did they really think that was going to work?
I think it's a sign of good faith for the fact that they made so much off the original. Hey, we know we made a ton. Here's a little polite, you know, thing. And now we know you're going to want more money for the sequel. But just a sign of good faith, I would assume.
Right. Precisely. And it was we should say that it was Michael Fleming of Deadline Hollywood that broke this story. And he says that they're all going to be making in the vicinity of $5 million and 4% of first dollar gross. And that means the second a dollar comes in, they get 4 pennies. So that's actually pretty good. So, you know, that's $15 million for the three stars plus 4% of first dollar gross. Hollywood's not doing first dollar gross these days anymore.
Are there three stars?
Yeah. Zach Galifianakis, Bradley Cooper, and Ed Helms.
Yeah.
What about, what's his name, the fourth guy?
Yeah. You can't even remember his name. And
yeah.
He appeared in like 5 minutes of the movie. So what's interesting is director, writer, producer Todd Phillips, who talk about taking different career paths. We were in the same film school class at NYU.
Whoops.
Yeah. Oh, well. He will be paid $10 million against 10% of the gross. So that means for every dollar that Warner Brothers makes on this film, 14 cents will go to the creative talent behind it, at least.
Good.
Now, what's interesting, I find, is that Todd Phillips, when he cast Galifianakis and Helms and Bradley Cooper, they were so unknown that the studio came back to him and said, look, you can cast these guys, but you can't do it for $34 million. You know, you can't make a movie for $34 million with these unknowns. So he gave up his upfront directing fee, which was quite substantial. He instead took 15% of The Hangover's total gross, and that includes video. To date, that's a figure pushing $50 million. Talk about a wise move.
I just want to put in one thing because it was bugging me who that fourth guy was. It was Justin Bartha.
Yeah.
And I'm not seeing him on IMDb's being in The Hangover 2, and the other guys are, so maybe he's just not in it.
Fleming does say that he is going to be in it, but he does not know how much he's going to be paid.
And by the way, if you ignore animated films, which are, of course, funny, like Shrek and Finding Nemo, the top grossing comedy of all time is Home Alone, which grossed $285 million in the U.S., just slightly above the $277 million of The Hangover. And that's also behind Meet the Fockers.
Man, you loved saying that.
You know, I remember in 1990, I was working for 20th Century Fox in their publicity department in New York, and I was tasked with... There was a screening of Home Alone, and it was the first film. Nobody knew who it was, and I was tasked with running around 57th Street in New York trying to get as many people as I possibly could to come in and see this movie. And nobody wanted to see this movie. And, of course, 3 weeks later, it's this huge hit.
I just like picturing you wandering the streets of the Upper West Side of Manhattan trying to solicit people on the street.
Well, I'd hand them this this little, you know, screening invitation, and it had Macaulay Culkin there grabbing his face. And
wah!
Yeah, and it just, they go, I don't think so. Thanks, though. You know, that was.
Couldn't you say the director, that it was, you know, from the guy who did Breakfast Club and 16 Candles? And
I did say that, but then they looked at the picture and went, yeah, even more reason not to see it.
Yeah, where's Molly Ringwald?
Right, precisely.
Well, this is a movie studio should know, always include a sequel clause. Even if you're going to have to renegotiate, if it explodes, at least you start at a better, you know, position of strength contract-wise.
Yeah, I wonder if there are any repercussions for the business development executive that negotiated that contract and did not put in an option clause.
Yeah, I mean, no matter how poorly you think it is, I would just assume it's just boilerplate. Boom, it's got to be in there. Right. I don't care if it's Romeo and Juliet. I can have a sequel clause in there.
Well, and certainly television contracts have that. Even when you're shooting a pilot, they'll put in, you know, this contract is for the next 4 seasons.
5 years. Yeah, five years.
And that's why you start getting all of these people and actors who, after 4 or 5 years, are asking for a load of money. It's because for the first 4 years, they were locked into some lowball contract. And if they were on a hit show, well, there was nothing they could do.
Well, no, actually, that's not true. I mean, often they renegotiate right away and they commit to further more time on the show, starting it right after the first year, second year. But that's why George Clooney never asked for a penny more on ER, because he always knew he wanted to leave the show. Not that he wasn't happy and didn't find it, you know, fulfilling, but he never asked for more money because he wanted to be able to walk away if he chose to after 4 or 5 seasons, which is exactly what he did. Everybody else locked in bigger money. And he said, no, thank you. I'm here for my 4 or 5 years and then I'm done. And you gotta admire that willingness to gamble on your film career, when he certainly was lucky to have his one hit show after about 20 pilots that he worked on.
Well, right, yes, that you can do that sometimes if you're the star of the show. I know a couple of actors who are kind of series regulars, and there was no way they could renegotiate their contracts. They just weren't big enough, either in name or on the show, to renegotiate. But it's all about...
Yeah, ask Georgia Fox about that.
Right. You know, it's all about leverage, and we're going to be talking a lot about leverage these days. It looks like the actors for The Hangover had a lot of leverage. And I guess a little later on, we're going to be talking about Charlie Sheen and whether he has any leverage. But first, why don't we talk about our good friend, Justin Bieber, who is, what, 16 years old?
He turned 16 on March 1st.
Ah, okay. Even more of a reason to hate him.
Wow, what does that make him, a Pisces?
I don't know.
Well, he has the number one record in the country this week. He sold 283,000 copies of his second album, My World 2.0. I guess his first album was called My World, so he's very original. You can see how he...
it's an EP, the first album, that's right.
Okay, and that's actually at number five. He's the first artist to have two albums in the top five since Nelly in 2004.
Go Bieber!
His song Baby is at number 8 on the Hot 100. He's been on all the talk shows. He performed on Letterman. He performed on Leno. He had about 14 people backing him up for his performance on Leno. He had 4 backup singers, 4 dancers, and 5 guys playing instruments. I've never seen so many people on a stage for just a pop song.
You need to drown the guy out, right?
But he did a very funny he can sing fine, and he did a very funny stunt with it's Will Ferrell's website, right? Funny or Die. That's Will Ferrell, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on April Fool's Day, they changed the name to Bieber or Die. And Justin Bieber said, yeah, that's right. I bought it. I own it. It's mine. And so everything, if it's not Bieber, it dies. And he had all these funny, funny little bits on the website about how he hires people so he can slap them in the face. And it's just all, yeah, I go swimming right after I eat. I don't care. And he just, it was
yeah,
very,
I give him
very
a lot
funny.
Of credit for that, for having a sense of humor to do that.
Yeah, it was very funny, and it was very amusing. They showed a bit of it on Leno, which is the first I heard of it. But Bieber or Die, all on April Fool's Day. And Josie's could be a talented actor, too, because he delivered his lines well. But it ties into a blog that I believe, did Karen post it or Sperling?
I posted this.
Yes, about an LA Times person blogged about Justin Bieber being at the Kids' Choice Awards on Nickelodeon. And they were very scathing about him. They said, in the midst of his two-minute career, the 16-year-old pop star seems to be developing a monster eagle. People are shocked at his dismissive attitude toward reporters and his refusal to get slimed, which is, of course, the whole point of showing up on Nickelodeon. And the kicker at the end was that maybe it's time for someone to have a curfew.
I thought that was a great
Justin
line.
Justin Bieber's getting an ego.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, apparently he has a swagger coach on staff. First of all, the guy has a staff, so that's
his fashion coach. Of course he has a staff. He's one of the hottest young acts in Hollywood. He's been groomed by Usher to become a big star. Of course he has a staff. He has a manager, he has an agent, he has a publicist, he has a fashion consultant. Of course he does.
You know, I have all of those things too.
I have a swagger consultant. What is that?
That's somebody
that's,
to go
that's
around.
That's really his fashion advisor, the person helping him with his outfits.
I thought it was the person that like helped him go and get free stuff. Swag.
The swag, no. Well, but
swagger.
I found this interesting because I've never really seen him speak, but I saw him on Leno and I saw him on a few other things. What's kind of interesting about Justin Bieber is that he's the first sort of kid growing up to be a hip-hop star. He's not trying to be Donny Osmond. He's trying to be Kanye West. So, yeah, he's on Leno and he's like, yeah, things are going smooth for me. And he's got that little attitude, but that's because he's imitating hip-hop stars like Diddy and Kanye West and all those people. Of course he's got an attitude. That's what he's imitating. That's what he's trying to be, is trying to be an egotistical hip-hop star. Now, of course, it's not good if he's becoming obnoxious, but yeah, you know, that swagger is exactly what he's trying to do. He's not trying to be Backstreet Boys. He's not trying to be, you know, whatever. He's a hip-hop star, and that's kind of unusual. We've had, like, Criss Cross and other people with sort of pop hip-hop things and what was his name?
Lil John.
Yeah. And so we've had younger people who've been hip hop stars, but I think this is really like pre-teen kid just growing up and trying to be a hip hop star from a teeny bopper age. You know, we haven't had a lot of hip hop stars like that. So I think his attitude is part of the hip hop thing. It's not, it wouldn't be right if he was a nice, sweet, innocent, wholesome kid and you're trying to be Kanye West. It doesn't work.
Yeah, but he looks like a wholesome kid. You know, he looks like Zach and Cody. He's the whitest guy on earth. Someone needs to be guiding him towards, you know, what he actually looks like. It's
well, then maybe they should be guiding.
Well, Usher and Justin Timberlake are guiding him. I mean, they both vied to sign him, and Usher is guiding him, and I think it's working. So
maybe
I guess those two guys know a little something about navigating the music world.
Maybe they should be guiding him to be a Latino pop star. What do you think?
Not the one you have in mind.
You're getting into NAMBLA territory here. What are you going to say next?
nothing. I was going to segue into the fact that Ricky Martin, a Latino pop star, is very, very
Oh, I thought
proud.
You were going to play a clip. Yes, he's a fortunate homosexual man, which I have been emailed about 20 times in the last 3 days. Every time I say something, someone says, you're a fortunate homosexual man.
As a matter of fact, like, he's calling you right now just to tell you himself that he is a very fortunate homosexual man.
Is it Bieber?
But I think, you know, what I posted on our Twitter account, which is at Showbiz Sandbox, if you care to look it up, was that, you know, Ricky Martin comes out as gay, surprising absolutely no one. And then, of course, I saw that same headline like 50 places. They all stole it from me, of course.
Well, GLAAD, actually, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation had a pretty good essay about why it matters that somebody comes out, even when you think, oh, everybody knows they're gay. But it actually really does matter. And and he's still a big star. And, you know, it's true that his star has dimmed a bit in the pop world. He had that brief you know, meteoric moment in the U.S., but he's been a big pop star and remains one in the Latin world. And obviously there's perhaps even more, stereotypically, we believe there's more prejudice against gays in the Latin and black communities than there is perhaps in mainstream white world. And so it means even more for them to come out. And there have been a couple others who have come out, like there's the singer in this big Mexican band, RBD, who came out like 2 years ago. And so it really does mean something. You can joke, Ricky Martin, he's old news. Well, not in the Latin world. He's still a big star there. So
I think the joke is not that Ricky Martin is old news, but more so that since the moment he appeared on the scene, everybody said he was gay, and that he just denied it and denied it and denied it. And 10 years later, when nobody cares anymore, now
but
is
that's
when
the
he's...
point. People do care in the Latin world. He's still a big, big star in the Latin world. He's not, you know, Richard Chamberlain coming out at the end of his life after 40 years after the Thornbirds. He still releases big, big, successful albums in the Latin world. He's still a big star there.
The way he came out was he posted something on his website, a statement on his website that was pretty long and only kind of got to the point at the very last paragraph. Did any of you read it?
No.
No.
Well, he says here... He says here, referring to twin sons he had via a surrogate in 2008, he wrote, "To keep living as I did up until today would be to indirectly diminish the glow that my kids were born with. Enough is enough. This has to change. This was not supposed to happen 5 or 10 years ago. It is supposed to happen now. Today is my day, this is my time, and this is my moment." He sounds like Michael Jackson.
Well, no. Well, it's nice that he wants to be a father and... you know, doesn't want to have to be lying with his kids. So that's good. The question, though, that you raise is from a Wall Street Journal blog item about whether you can be gay and be a successful pop star.
I think the answer to that is yes.
I think the answer to that is still up in the air. I thought that was really an interesting article.
Well, okay. So the Wall Street Journal on their Speakeasy blog said they examined a couple of careers of male singers after they came out. So Elton John, before, was a Grammy-winning pop star who sold millions of records worldwide. After, he was a Grammy-winning pop star who still sells millions of records worldwide.
Yeah, but he was never a sex symbol.
Okay, good.
Well, now you're asking a different question.
Well, okay, George Michael was a sex symbol before one of the biggest pop stars in the world. First,
and it did affect him.
First as half of the pop duo Wham, and then as a solo artist. Now, after he came out, his album Patience, which was released in 2004, did not sell as well as the releases before his heyday, such as Faith and, I guess, what's the other one? I can't remember his other album.
Listen Without Prejudice. He has a number of albums.
Right. But then he was already kind of on the decline as he came out, so...
Yeah,
he's a very big,
good.
Big star in Europe still. He's a huge selling and huge touring star in Europe, even to this day. He has massively successful tours. His album of greatest hits was a massive European hit. So he's still a big star around the world, not necessarily in the U.S. And, of course, the U.K. has a huge history of openly gay people being big pop stars like Pet Shop Boys and Culture Club, ultimately, and others.
Well, now, they also... talk about two American Idol finalists, Clay Aiken. Before, the vocalist finished second to Ruben Studdard on American Idol, but he far outsold the champ in his 2003 debut album, Measure of a Man. And after, some Claymates went public with their disappointment over the singer coming out, and Aiken's last album, On My Way Here, debuted at number 4 on the charts and didn't generate anything approaching the interest of his debut.
But I don't think that album was... very good anyway.
Right, yeah. The question is it because of, you know, some people come out long after their pop success, like perhaps Ricky Martin in the U.S. Others, like Clay Aiken, he's had success on Broadway and elsewhere after coming out. So he still has a viable career. And that album was sort of a very contentious one for him and his record label. So, you know, I don't think he's necessarily hurt him. I think people generally just didn't care.
Well, what about Adam Lambert? The Wall Street Journal also... talks about
I think
Adam
it's
Lambert.
Been nothing but a plus for him.
Karen?
Yeah, but that was always kind of part of his shtick, was that he was kind of over the top. So just the fact that he's gay just goes along with the shtick.
I need a shtick, I think.
He would not have made the cover of Rolling Stone if he was straight. I don't think he would have. He lost American Idol and got the cover of Rolling Stone. You know, and he's been pretty much clearly gay from the day he stepped out on stage on Idol, and yet he came very close to winning the whole thing and got the cover of Rolling Stone and still gets attention all the time. David Bowie in the early 70s made huge hay out of claiming to be bisexual. He later said it wasn't true, but it was the smartest thing he ever said. But that made him, oh my God, he's so controversial and exciting. And he's had obviously a massively long career. And of course, there's Katie Lang and Melissa Etheridge and Rufus Wainwright and big UK group Scissor Sisters and Micah, Tracy Chapman, Erasure, Judas Priest, the guy in Boyzone who's now dead, unfortunately, but he came out. I mean, there's a growing, I think, list of people who have been successful. You know, Katie Lang came out. She's the toast of the Olympics. She's, you know, heralded as Canada's, you know, ambassador to the world in a way, appearing in the opening ceremonies at the Olympics. So, but anyway, I think there's a growing list of people who start their careers openly gay in the middle, at the end. So I think there's a growing acceptance, but there's still that, like Karen points out, that, you know, can you be a romantic lead movie star and be out? Can you be a sexy pop star appealing to the girls and be out? And they were still waiting for those walls to fall in a way.
Well, I know last week I was talking to a television producer who is working on two different pilots right now. And both pilots revolve around either having two fathers or two mothers. There was a gay character.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Yeah, there was a character in every single one of them that was gay. And I said, you know, what's funny is I remember back in, I think, 96, working at CAA.
My two dads.
No, not my two dads. It was Ellen DeGeneres coming out on her show. It was such a big deal. Would America take to having a gay character on a television show, on a network television show? And I thought at the time, who cares? Now, every other show has a gay character on it. Modern Family has a gay character on it.
There were plenty of gay characters before that. The point was that Ellen was the lead, and she came out after people grew to like her. So it was quite different. But there have been plenty of gay characters on TV before that.
I'm saying it's a big whoop. You're saying it's a big deal. That's a sure sign that we should head into our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we decide whether the top news stories of the week, at least the top entertainment news stories of the week, are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story this week is also about television, and it's about Charlie Sheen, who wants to exit Two and a Half Men. So I guess they rename it One and a Half Men.
I guess they take it off the air.
Yeah, well, I mean, People Magazine is saying that he's kind of done, that even though CBS picked up the show through 2012... that he doesn't really want to join it again. Of course, he's had some trouble lately with the law and with rehab and with tabloids.
But, you know, you want to talk about business affairs people who screwed up. I mean, who picks up a show without making sure that the actors are on the same time frame?
Well, that happens a lot of times, right? Things get out of sync. I mean, it happened on 24, you know.
Right, and that's where I was mentioning we were going to be talking about leverage again. So he has a little bit of leverage here to up the ante, because, or at least up his paycheck, because, you know, the show can run through 2012, but they don't have him through 2012. So if they want him and they want to continue to have that show, which is kind of a ratings powerhouse, then they're going to have to pony up. And right now he already makes $850,000 an episode.
You know, the real question is, can the show go on without him?
Well, I don't know, Karen. Is it a big deal or a big whoop that he wants to leave?
I think it's a big deal. It's a big deal that he wants to leave. Whether the show could go on without him, I think, is another question. I thought it was really funny. You put in the show notes that someone suggested that Michael J. Fox replace him, which is really funny. I think he could be replaced for a year as an experiment, and if it doesn't work, cancel the show.
Well, Michael J. Fox can't replace him. He's not. I don't think he's physically capable of
doing
a half hour show.
That was a joke. But you remember how Charlie Sheen replaced Michael J. Fox in Spin City.
Right, that was the joke.
Oh, Lord, I forgot. Yeah. So,
Keep up, Michael, keep up.
So, Michael, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
I say it's a big deal. It's the number one comedy in the country. If he leaves, I'm sure they will continue it for another season, but it won't work. It'll stagger to its death. You know, it'll go along with momentum, but it doesn't make any sense without him.
What's Emilio Estevez doing right now? Let's slide him in.
He's a film director.
Our next story is about Will Smith, you know, the actor. Well, it turns out he may be returning to Independence Day, or at least Independence Day 2 or 3. IESB, a website I had never heard of until this past week, has posted on their website a story that he has been locked down for Independence Day 2 and 3, and that they will shoot them back-to-back and potentially in 3D.
Well, I want to know why you said Will Smith, the actor, as opposed to what, Will Smith, the Kennedy? I mean, what other Will Smith would we be talking about?
You know, it was my way of, you know, adding a little personality.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop? A big whoop. I so don't care about this.
Now, Independence Day made, I think, $800 million. It made $1 billion with video.
Yeah, but I don't know that you can repeat that. I think that'd be a hard thing to repeat with this movie.
Well, remember, the movie came out in 1996, so it's 14 years later. I mean...
That's why.
Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I say it's a big whoop for the moment because it's been reported by IESB, which, as you point out, nobody has ever heard of. It's been picked up, I see, by The Guardian in the UK and Ain't It Cool News and Cinematical. Everybody's reporting that IESB, which nobody's heard of, is reporting that Will Smith is locked up for two sequels. But guess what? If this was true, it should be in Variety. It should be in Hollywood Reporter. I don't see it anywhere except referencing this website that we've never heard of. And therefore, it's a rumor that you shouldn't be giving any credence to. This is a classic example of the internet. Sort of people just pick up crap on the web and they repeat it just because they want to, even though they don't care. Well, what's the source? Why isn't there somebody quoted? Why isn't the studio quoted? Why isn't Variety reported it? And yet it's been repeated on websites all over the world. So pay attention to what the source is.
And now it's been repeated on this show. So
yes, but we've knocked it down.
That's right.
Yeah, but I just want to point out that at one point, nobody had ever heard of this little website called TMZ either. I mean, it's because we've
No. When you get a website claiming that a major studio with one of the biggest stars in the world is relaunching a franchise, and there's not a quote from anybody in the studio, and there's not a quote, and every single story about it simply quotes that original item that has no source in it, you know something fishy's up.
Right. Okay. Moving on.
Moving on to 30 Rock. According to Entertainment Weekly, Matt Damon will be a guest star on one of the later episodes of this season, and he will be playing Tina Fey's love interest, and he may have more than one episode. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for Tina Fey. I'd like to date Matt Damon, but in general, it's a big whoop, but it's a fascinating example of people going back and forth between movies and TV.
Karen?
Kudos to him for doing this, but I agree that ultimately it's a big whoop.
Well, then I guess we should move on to Glee, another television show, which is holding nationwide casting calls online through their MySpace page. You can record one of the songs that they, I guess, were featured on the show, True Colors, You Can't Always Get What You Want, or Lean On Me. Each video has to be under 5 minutes. You have to introduce yourself. You have to be between the ages of 16 and 26. And
darn it.
You post them on the website there, and they're going to pick somebody. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
You know, I guess it's a big deal because it's just an interesting way of kind of interactivity with a TV show.
Michael?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal marketing-wise. They might find someone just like Justin Bieber was discovered on YouTube, but it's just a very clever way of, you know, getting people involved in the show and feeling a part of it and, you know, stumbling perhaps on some real talent.
Well, and I agree. For all those reasons, it's a great way to market the show. Hey, it's a great way to market MySpace. I had no idea that they had karaoke on MySpace. Actually, I did know that. But, you know, the fact that they're doing it on MySpace, it's a big deal for MySpace.
Yeah, really.
Well, isn't Glee on Fox?
Yeah.
I mean, you think they were going to put this on Facebook?
Yeah, actually, good point.
Good point.
Touché.
Synergy, folks. Synergy.
Leverage. Going back to that leverage. Our next story is about Lady Gaga, who is rumored, so I'm going to say this up front, is rumored to possibly, maybe, be singing the new James Bond theme for the next movie. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal in a way. I mean, it makes a perfect sense. It's a smart pairing of her and them. She's perfectly over the top. It makes perfect sense.
Karen?
I say big whoop because neither one really needs the other.
They were going to have Amy Winehouse, but she was too muddled to be able to do it for Quantum of Solace. Hopefully she'll be back again at some point because she would be a good choice too.
That would be a good choice.
Too muddled.
I didn't know how else to put it.
No, it was very nicely put. Moving on.
Moving on to our next story, which is about AMC, the cable channel here in the United States. They have given a green light to 6 episodes of Waking Dead. So this is going to be a series based on the Image Comics franchise by Robert Kirkman. The pilot was written by Frank Darabont, who will also direct and executive produce. This is a zombie show. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
Big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal. AMC is the hot little network, even better than HBO. They've got Mad Men. They have Breaking Bad, the best show on television right now. And if Frank Darabont's doing the pilot, that means it'll be 7 hours long.
Well, Kirkman's comic premiered in 2003 and has become one of the medium's landmark titles. With its harsh and unflinching depiction of a world overrun by zombies and the increased desperation of the few surviving humans. The series' main character is Rick Grimes, a former police officer. There are dozens of other human characters, but as HitFix points out, it's probably best not to get too attached to them because they're probably going to wind up dead at some point. And this is a show that's been picked up for 6 episodes, not AMC's customary 13 or 12. It should be interesting. They're going to air it in October, during their annual Fear Fest Halloween celebration. Our next story is about the New York Times on the Kindle, which is raising its price for that platform from $15 a month to $20 a month, up 33%. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because they're pricing themselves out of the market. $204 a year just to read something online is too much money.
Karen?
Big deal for the same reason.
Well, and of course, the Wall Street Journal on the iPad is $17.99. The iPad sold 300,000 units on its first day. Is that a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
I think anytime that Apple releases anything, it's a big deal.
Michael?
I say it's a big whoop. Let me know how much it sold in its first year.
Our next story is about Vin Diesel, Rob Friedman, and the sports action movie XXX or Triple X. Turns out, Sony's letting it go over to Paramount. Sony released the first two movies, and the third film will actually be shot in 3D with Vin Diesel, the original star, back in the main role, Rob Friedman back behind the camera, and Paramount will release it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Oh my! Well, it's a big whoop. I thought you meant porn was in 3D, which I thought would be a big deal, but you just mean another feature film is in 3D. That's not so exciting.
Karen?
It's a big deal for Vin Diesel if this is a hit movie, because he needs one. But otherwise, big whoop.
Then moving on to George Lucas, who is developing an animated Star Wars comedy TV series. Looks like Seth Green of Robot Chicken will be involved, as are the writers from The Daily Show. No network has been announced and no release date. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, since there's no network and no release date, it's going to be a big whoop. But I would so watch a show that was written by Seth Green and the writers from The Daily Show.
Michael.
It's a big deal because keep trying to expand that franchise. And they've had so much success with like the Robot Chicken Star Wars and Family Guy Star Wars spoofs. It makes sense.
Sarah Palin has a new show on Fox. It debuted to 2.073 million people, more than all other news channels combined. Now, I guess it's on Fox News. It's not on the Fox network.
Yes, Fox News. Yes, sorry.
It held 90% of its lead-in, but it does drop in viewers every 15 minutes.
Not a good sign.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. You can run for president and yet have a new show on Fox News and a reality show on the Discovery Channel. It's a whole new way of running for president.
The reality president.
Yeah.
Karen?
You know, it's a big deal because if you are going to use this as a platform to run for president, you kind of want people to watch.
Well, the show got lambasted by critics, but 2 million people watching, that's actually a lot of people watching on a cable network.
Well, it doesn't place it in the top 20 of cable shows for the week. It's a solid ranking for a news channel. Huffington Post tried to paint it as a disastrous debut, but the show that it led in from Sean Hannity's show, it had like 2.5 million people. So it held on to 2.2 million people. So it really held on to most of its lead in, held on to most of its important demos. It was not the disaster. But in weeks to come, if audience sampled it and hated it, as Karen says, when you drop every 15 minutes, it's not a good sign. So in weeks to come, if it declines, then you'll know what people thought of it.
Well, okay then. I'm going to move on to our next story. Cal Penn. So long, White House. Hello, Kumar.
Okay, remember how Cal Penn left House because he was going to go work for Obama?
And Obama.
He was going to be like associate director of community outreach or whatever.
I do remember that.
Yeah. Well, now he's leaving that job and he's going to go and make the next Harold and Kumar film.
Because that's, I guess, failing upwards. I don't really know why he would.
Well, see, if I hadn't announced it, I would have given the actual kicker. I would say this is actually not a big deal because his whole point was that he was only going to stay with that job for a year. But I did think it was interesting that the title of this, and I'll bet that the title of most accounts of this story basically has him leaving the White House to make a Harold and Kumar movie, when that really isn't the case. But I just think it's interesting. But it's interesting, you know, that you go from being an actor and you go to working for the White House, and you go back and you're an actor again. I mean, I think it's sort of wonderful, actually.
Yeah, they spent a year doing that. It makes me like him a lot more. I've interviewed him. He's a nice guy. And the next Harold and Kumar movie is a set in Christmas time, when nothing says Christmas quite like Bud, does it? So I say it's a big deal.
Good for Cal Penn. Now, speaking of going back to things, I know, Karen, you have to leave us because you have a meeting for your, you know, I don't know, you're going to
be... I just got slammed. I got slammed on a Monday. I hate getting slammed on a Monday, but...
You know, it's tough being the king of all social networking in Hollywood.
It's tough being wanted. It really is.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We'll say goodbye to you now, and we'll get Neil Feldman on. He is the president and CEO of In3. This is the company that actually did the post-production work that dimensionalized Alice in Wonderland from 2D to 3D. So let me try and dial him up now. And Karen, thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye. Just dialed him up here on Skype.
Hello.
Hi, Neil. This is Sperling.
Hi, Sperling. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I don't see you, but I hear you.
Oh, hold on. Let me turn on my camera here. Wow, we should be doing a video podcast. I have Michael Giltz here on the other line. He's one of our co-hosts. And the reason we wanted to talk to you this week was because there's been a lot of news recently about 2D versus 3D. 3D content, of course, being kind of Hollywood's new it technology, if you will. 3D movies are making a mint at the box office, but it's caused a lot of studios to rethink some of their 2D productions and attempt to transform them into 3D content or 3D releases. This was done with Clash of the Titans, and it received a lot of flack. Now, you run a company that does just this. It takes a 2D film and transforms it into 3D. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what In3D does and what was different about what it did for Alice in Wonderland and what was done for Clash of the Titans.
Yeah, let me just tell you that I believe all the flack that they're getting is absolutely deserved. quality can't be compromised in 3D. I think something that's been missed here, and it's still early, you know, it did okay in the box office and everybody's looking at the box office, but the real tale will be told next week, how much it drops off, and in subsequent weeks, as the public starts to talk about what experience they had watching this movie. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence that people were just taking their glasses off and watching the movie in 2D. And there's a lot of people recommending that if you're going to see the movie, see it in 2D, because there's no point in paying extra. The difference between what we did on Alice or G-Force is that we were held to the highest standards of quality. And I'm just amazed and frankly appalled that a major studio like Warner's has put their imprint on this movie. I would understand it for someone else, you know, looking for a cheap and dirty approach. But quite honestly, if you go back and, you know, look in history, we were the first company to pioneer the idea of doing quality conversions that would rival anything that's shot with dual cameras. And our, you know, we were basically put on the map by George Lucas in 2005 when he did a presentation with Jim Cameron at Show West. And what Lucas did, he got on stage and he showed work that we did at N3 of converting clips from Star Wars. I think we showed some Top Gun. We showed some things from Disney, Lilo and Stitch. We had a bunch of different examples, different genres to prove the point. But it was too early in the game. I mean, that was really just months before Chicken Little. And in fact, that show inspired Chicken Little to be converted by Disney into 3D. But there's no way that George or Jim Cameron or anybody would put their imprint on you know, a conversion unless it was perfect or as close to perfect as possible. And Clash is just not that. It makes tremendous compromises. We're just dismayed to see that this is possibly going to poison the well for good quality conversions.
Now, when you're going to convert a film, Tim Burton started to shoot Alice in Wonderland in 3D, or at least this was the story we were told, that he started to shoot in 3D. It went a couple of days. He said, you know what, guys, go home. We'll just do it all in post-production, because he knew that N3 was out there and could dimensionalize the film after it was shot. But you left somebody there on the set, a stereoscopic engineer. Is that correct?
No, not on Alice. Although it would have been nice if we had somebody there. The story with Alice is, I can't confirm that Tim, you know, when he made his decision, he did come and talk to us a week or so before they started production and saw our demos and all. And he did choose to do in conversion. And the basic reason is that he got much more artistic flexibility by doing a conversion. And this is really the key in what's going on. The traditional way of shooting 3D is with two cameras mounted side by side, more or less the distance between human eyes, but not necessarily. And in fact, you want to be able to move that interocular distance for various effects. But in conversion, we can take flat 2D material and convert it and do it as if it was shot with dual cameras. But we can do much, much more. We can fix problems that you might have had if you shot dual camera. We can match the scenes as you put them together in the post-production process. Because if you shoot dual camera and you shoot perfectly on the set, and there are people out there who do it very well, you still don't know what you're going to get when you go into the edit suite. And it may very well be that artistically you're choosing decisions where your eyes are being forced to rapidly move back and forth between scenes. Well, that's going to cause a headache. That's going to cause fatigue. That's a no-no. Quite honestly, if you put a pencil to it and you look at the overall budget, not just looking at pieces, but the overall budget, if you have a live action movie like Alice in Wonderland, and there's a lot of effects, a conversion is probably going to turn out to be cheaper and give you more artistic freedom to make choices that you want. And Tim, I have to say, first off, we converted a lot of the movie. We didn't do all of it. There were a couple of other companies that worked on it. But Tim made some artistic choices that the audience might not agree with. For example, when we were first asked to do the bookends, the beginning and the end, we did the 3D perfectly, and Tim wanted it toned down. He wanted to emphasize the 3D when Alice goes down the rabbit hole. So, you know, an audience member might say, well, that kind of looked flat to me. I didn't like that. But that wasn't a limitation of the technology, and it wasn't a choice on our part. It was, in fact, the beauty of what conversion is all about. We can give the artist exactly what he wants. You cannot do that when you shoot dual camera. What you shoot is what you get.
Now, Neil, when someone is shooting a movie in 2D, but they know they're going to convert it, that also, I assume, makes them do the production design differently than they would if they knew it was just going to be seen in 2D. Isn't that right?
Well, there's an overall philosophical idea that regardless of how you shoot it, you want to plan your 3D if you're going to have a 3D movie. Then you have all kinds of tools at your disposal to get there. Now, if you do know you're going to do a conversion, then there are things you can do on the set to speed up the conversion process and to make it less expensive. And that's why we'd like to have somebody on the set, because we can make those suggestions while the production is going on, but they're still artistic decisions that may or may not be acceptable. And, again, this is purely a matter of trying to save money in the budget. It has nothing to do technically with the end product or the planning of the 3D. Any good 3D is going to have a depth script that's going to be thought out. And, where you might be applying this idea about not thinking in 3D is on conversions of legacy movies. Because, yes, they were not thought at the time to, have any possibility of being seen in 3D. So that's a little different area. But if you're setting out on a new project and you're going to do 3D, it doesn't matter whether it's conversion or shot dual camera. You want to plan your 3D appropriately to use this new media to its best advantage.
Well, was it G-Force that you had somebody on the set for? I remember hearing you say that at some point that you...
We did have a person on the set, and I don't want to tell you what movie it is because we ended up not doing the movie.
Oh, okay.
But well, yeah, we did have somebody. We gave them all sorts of pointers, and we learned a bitter lesson.
Well, now you say that all films that are going to shoot in 3D will have this depth script, But now let's take Clash of the Titans as an example. It was in no way, shape, or form going to be a 3D film. So it did not have that during production and probably throughout most of post-production.
One of the many reasons why this was a very bad example of a conversion. You're absolutely right.
Well, it did do fairly well. It made $61 million. Do you think
But you know, I don't mean to interrupt, but somebody's got to answer to me what it would have made if it had only been out in 2D on that first weekend. What's the difference for the money they spent, which wasn't cheap. And again, if the overall short-term gain, you know, Warner's looks like, they're really smart. They also look to me rather cynical, because if the public really goes for this, then the public is going to be robbed of seeing what good quality conversions can do, because obviously the studios will always go for the bottom line. However, I suspect that the public is already getting educated in what good 3D is. They saw it with Avatar. They've seen it with a slew of animated movies. And now they're seeing a really bad 3D. And we'll see what happens. I have a feeling that not only is this a problem for conversions, it's a problem for 3D in general, because now all of a sudden the bloom is off the rose. Here's the public watching 3D and they're taking their glasses off because they don't like it. I mean, that's what happened when you watched your father's 3D. That's exactly the reason that 3D died, you know, three deaths already. And it can't last. Either we do quality, no matter how you get there, shooting dual camera properly and thinking it out, or conversions, or then you're back to this idea that it's just a gimmick and it's going to die. And I actually don't believe that. I think that the top creatives like Jim Cameron, George Lucas, Peter Jackson, these guys know what quality is. They would never, ever allow the kind of conversion that was done on Clash to touch their movies. I'm convinced of that.
Well, I know that that is exactly why 3D died in the past. Not only was it done cheaply, but it was done just with gimmicky poor B movies. All they did was throw some spears at you and figured people would be excited. It never really had the range of quality movies that we're seeing today being done in 3D. This is really the first chance 3D has had to be an artistic medium, an artistic form at the movies, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. You remember, Dial M for Murder was shot by Hitchcock in 3D. And so there
were technical reasons. Terrible movie. the most exciting thing was a phone.
I'm not saying there were a lot of good 3D examples back then, but there were technical issues that have been solved in projection and in an acquisition. But basically, the bottom line is anything that takes you out of the story is a no-no. And that's the problem with Clash. You know, if you're conscious of 3D, bad 3D or even good 3D, then you're taking it away from watching the content. That is not what's happening with this new wave of 3D. This new 3D, and the way I look at it, is I call it surround sound for your eyes. It's basically drawing you into the story more. It's making you more of a voyeur, so to speak. And it's, you know, you're going to choose a theater that if you're talking audio that has surround sound versus the theater that's only in stereo, because you know you're going to have a better experience. You're going to be more into the movie. It's the same thing with 3D. You'll choose 3D because it's going to be a better experience. If you don't have a better experience and it's already out there with Clash, then all bets are off. So, you know, this is an interesting exercise. I'm sure it's going to be repeated by some others. But I think the bitter lesson in the end is that Hollywood could shoot itself in the foot if it really goes down this path, which is kind of silly.
Well, you know, they're very good at shooting themselves in the foot, so they've got a lot of experience at it. Do you find that after Avatar and Alice in Wonderland, that the number of phone calls coming into N3 have increased? And is it mostly new projects, films that are in production or about to enter production, or is it on catalog titles?
Well, first off, yes, our phones rung off the hook. It's quite amazing. In fact, that's why we're undertaking a joint affiliation with Reliance Media Works in India, so we can have the capacity to meet the demand. Secondly, the answer is we're seeing both now. Up until now, it was mostly new productions. But people now are getting serious about looking at some legacy stuff and some really good legacy stuff.
Well, I know that George Lucas at one point toyed around, as you mentioned, with Star Wars. Is there any update on that? Is he going to go back and maybe tweak that a bit, or
well,
does he have any plans?
George has never lost his interest in doing it. It was funny when he made that announcement. That was at Show West 2005, and he didn't tell us. He made it in front of the whole audience. I just about fell out of my chair. But then when we followed up with him, he said, yes, I do want to do this, but I want 5,000 3D equipped theaters before I'll even start. And quite honestly, we're still not at 5,000 theaters. Now there's a business side to this. And actually, that's one of the other little subplots that's going on with Clash, which is that there's still a shortage of 3D theaters. And now all the studios are, you know, in a food fight to get their hands on as many theaters so that they can get the return that they're seeing. He's, I think, being a sharp businessman, is going to wait and see until that all settles out and until there's ample theaters for him to put his content on.
Well, now, would you turn down somebody that offered you money to convert a movie in 8 weeks? Would you just say we don't want to be involved in shoddy work, and we'd be afraid of hurting our reputation by doing something in such a quick rush way?
Yeah, I've already done it.
So, and we should say that Clash of the Titans was converted in 8 weeks. They decided in early January to go for a 3D release in April.
I mean, you know, the sad and nice thing, I guess. It's sad for the public because they are still, this whole 3D thing is new. I've been looking at 3D since 2000. So I know what good and bad 3D is. The public doesn't necessarily know that yet. But within the industry, I think the industry was appalled by what was going on because we'd all seen the demos done by the company that did the conversion, and they were some of the worst work that anyone had seen. So it's not that this is a surprise to anybody that it looks bad. We knew that, and I know what it takes and what we can do in 8 weeks. And it's not worth it to us right now. Now, if the whole industry goes that way, it's easy for me to do bad stuff. And I can match any price and turnaround time of anybody if you don't care about the quality. But that's not been our experience dealing with the other studios at all. In fact, it's been quite the contrary. They have demanded very high things, standards from us, which have forced our R&D to always, you know, respond. And we've learned from each project we've done, from G-Force and from Alice in Wonderland and other projects, we always learn about, you know, the demands and trying to meet the quality bar that's been set.
Are you eager to see like a drama, a Woody Allen film, something that isn't a spectacle being shot in 3D? Because we saw films like Coraline and Up, which do have flashy moments, but are very sort of humanistic films that really use the 3D subtly and beautifully. And it'd be fascinating to see an actual drama use 3D in an interesting and intelligent way.
Yeah. First off, I'm glad you mentioned, because especially movies like Up, when I said there's a depth script, the audience may or may not be aware that the shaping of the characters changed depending on the emotional response that the directors wanted. You know, there'd be more depth and more, you know, sort of more comfy stuff. And you could follow a depth script when you're doing an animated movie because everything is rendered in the computer. What dimensionalization in particular brings to live action is we can do the same thing now with live action. And we actually did that for Alice in Wonderland. Unfortunately, we flattened things out, but still, that's that whole point is now you have that artistic freedom. As far as a drama, when we would do our demos, we would show all genres, and we converted 12 Angry Men, and you know, some people might say that's a waste of time, but quite honestly, it was wonderful because you felt like you were, you know, sweating it out inside the room there with all the other jury members, and it felt real. So I want to bring every kind of genre in front of the public and let them decide, because we've heard the debates. It goes back and forth about it has to be science fiction, has to be horror, it has to be, you know, live action, this and that. No, I believe everybody's going to find their favorite kind of genre in this. There's no one right or wrong way. And one other thing that's fascinating to realize, and we've known this for years, but now that the creatives are starting to play in this arena, is that the pace of the movies are going to slow down again, because you want to be able to drink in everything that's going on in a 3D scene. And so these fast action cuts are kind of disappointing. You can't get into what's going on because it's all gone before you see it.
Well, Neil, thank you very much for joining us and explaining a little bit about what it is In3 does and the difference between, I guess, a good conversion and bad conversion. And, you know, we all learned a new word, interocular vision, or interocular separation, really, is the phrase. I guess if people want to learn a little bit more, they can go to your website, in-3.com, correct?
Absolutely. And we also have a blog if they want to sign up. Every now and then we send out little, interesting tidbits about what we're doing or what's happening in the industry. You know, it's an exciting time for 3D. That's the good news. I hope the public really responds strongly and demands quality in their experiences, because that's, to me, why this 3D thing is happening now and why it's going to be long lasting.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
I should have mentioned this with Neil when we had him, but you can also find In3 on Twitter. @In3 is the username to look up. We're on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is the username to look up. And what did you think, Michael?
I thought it was interesting. I'd love to see the footage of 12 Angry Men, I'll tell you that.
Well, we thank Neil Feldman for taking the time to speak with us. If you want to find his website or want links to his website, you can find them in the show notes for episode 48. Those will be on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts like Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook and YouTube and you name it. You can also find ways to contact us on the website. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to send your comments off to. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group whose album is coming out, I think, in a couple of weeks, actually, and they will be playing Coachella in April. You can find them on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. You can find Michael Giltz online. He's at michaelgiltz.com. He's also on Twitter. @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. You can find Karen online as well. KarenWoodwardOnline.com is the website to go visit. And she's on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is her username on Twitter. My username on Twitter is @Sperling. And some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Michael, anything else for this week?
That's it.
All right, perfect. Until next week, play nice.